Kevin, I'd like you to meet Bob. We have the newcomer and the old timer, and that's how Alcoholics Anonymous works. Thank you so much for participating. All right, so I am going to start our sharing for our panel, and they are going to each share their experience, strength, and hope with us for 20 minutes. And I would like to start off with Charlie C., please, for 44 years.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Charlie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Charlie.
And I would like to thank my friend Mike for inviting me to do this. Mike is one of those activists. He's always on the go, and he's a good AA guy. We've known each other for almost 40 years. So thank you for having me, Mike. And as for the Mammoth trip, they were trying to sell us tickets to the Mammoth raffle at the table, and it was worth, this is like 10 o'clock, it was worth $700. And now it's $1,700, so if you haven't bought a ticket yet, I'd wait till around 3 o'clock, because it'll be worth about $12,000 by then, so just so you know. And I'm here with my friends, and I'm really the mascot of this group. I'm also the one that has really the least to say. I'm sober 44 years. I got sober on the 11th of June of 1981. It had not been a good year so far in 1981, and I got here just like most of us do. I wish I had something really dramatic to tell you, like I came here in my urine-soaked pajamas, you know, and showed up at a meeting, but then I have to deconstitute what is urine-soaked exactly, because I've heard somebody say that. I mean, is it soaked, or is it a spot? And I would guess that pretty much anything the size of a quarter or bigger would be, you wet your pants. But I came here with what I think everybody comes here with, and that was desperation. It doesn't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter where you live. It doesn't matter what your skin color is or your religion. It doesn't matter how much money you make or what kind of a car you drive. It doesn't matter. Nothing matters except desperation in sobriety. That's it. And I must have been, sometimes you don't even know if you're I didn't know I was desperate when I got here. I had no idea. Hi, friend. I had no idea I was desperate until I started taking actions that anybody else would have gone, are you serious? Like, I want to get sober. I need to get sober. I don't want to drink anymore. And they go, okay, you're gonna clean up ashtrays after the meeting. Well, that perhaps you didn't hear what I was saying. I just want to get sober. Yeah, well then take another commitment tomorrow night, and you can sweep. Okay, fine, but you're misinterpreting what I'm saying. And they just kept giving me things to do. From the first meeting I went to, I was told, you know, you can help set up chairs. I didn't ask what to do. I asked what were you going to do to show me how to stay sober, because I was a mess. I'd been peeing blood for a while. I'd been, I'm one of those quiet alcoholics where, I wouldn't say quiet, but I've got a big mouth when I drink. I just didn't have a flamboyant flame out because there wasn't much of me to start with. I never lost my ideals because I really didn't have many ideals that I knew of. I didn't fall from a great height because I never took the time to climb to a great height. I was 30 years old when I got sober. I'd been married. I was in the middle of a divorce. The woman I had married loved me, and I did not have any idea of how to be a husband in that relationship because I was mostly focused on me. And that wasn't like I was sitting around going, okay, do this for me and do that for me. It was, what am I getting out of this? I'm not happy. I'm not happy. And I thought it had to do with the marriage, but really all it had to do with was that's how I react to life. I'm just not happy. My mother had four babies. I was the third one out of four, and they all died at birth except for me. And I had no compassion for my mom about that. I felt sad for her, but I never understood in a deeper way how devastating that must have been to her to have. I just turned 75 last Tuesday, and all I could think about that day was my mom and how scared she must have been going in to have me when she lost two babies in the previous 4 years. And then she's going in now to have a third one, and she'd kind of just written it off, you know? And so I lived a pretty self-contained life. I had not much of an interaction with my parents. I don't think that we were, you know, back in the 50s, you weren't like your parents' best pal like you are now. Back in the 50s, they were your parents, and you were your child, and you just, when they gave you a look, you knew what to do. It was like, shut up. My dad had been a Marine Corps drill instructor, and all he had to do was look over at me, and I was like, oh, okay, I get it. And I was a nice kid. My mom and I went to church. My dad was a Methodist, but my mom and I were Catholics, and he dutifully drove us to church every Sunday. And we didn't have a lot of resources, but what we had was enough to keep us going, you know. And I was mediocre in school. I was a good speller. I was sick a lot, so I was out of school a lot, but I was a good speller, so I could manage to get through, you know. And it helped me out with girls later on. And I just was a mediocre everything. I went through high school with nothing to speak of except my potential. And man, I had that in spades because everybody told me about it. Everybody, you know, counselors and priests and teachers and everybody had to tell my parents of what potential I had. And I got out of school and I didn't go to college right. I went to college. I managed to get enough. I went to college when I was 17, and I graduated when I was 30. You can fill in all the blanks, you know. And the point I'm making about this is the person that went into a party one time when I didn't even want to be in a party because I don't like people. It's just my nature. I just don't like people. I'm sorry. I got a little better about 25, 30 years, and that's all started going downhill again. But I don't like people, and I demand their approval all the time, which is exhausting. And I got convinced to go to a party, and I went to this party, and somebody, you know, I'm standing there judging everybody because that's what I do. I would have been a great judge were it not for the fact that you have to base your decisions on facts. But I'm at this party and I'm just judging away, and somebody handed me a can of malt liquor. And you know, my dad had drunk, my parents weren't heavy drinkers, and my dad had a six pack of beer that would last him the weekend, you know. And Schlitz, always Schlitz. And so this guy hands me this can of malt liquor, which was, in those days, I don't know what can of malt liquor looks like anymore, but in those days, this is a regular beer can, and a can of malt liquor went down about this far, and they had a bag you could put it in the liquor store just for a can of malt liquor, where you put it in the bag, you twist the bottom, and they called it a freeway flyer. But anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. I got this can of malt liquor, and I thought if my father finds out I've been drinking, he's going to kill me. I was 18. I just turned 18. If the Catholic Church finds out I've been drinking, oh God, I'm going to be excommunicated. But no one's offering me a Pepsi. I'm holding this like I'm holding a lab experiment at this party. And I took, you know, opened this thing up and started drinking. And about halfway through that can of malt liquor, I came to the realization that I'd been way too hard on you people. I began to feel. Every alcoholic knows this feeling where it's just, I can't bear this. Glug, glug, glug. Whew. Oh, yes. Where did that come from? I just felt alive inside. I felt happier. I felt joy for the first time. I didn't know what joy was until I experienced it after I took a drink. Before then, I had no idea what a joy was. And I felt joy, and I felt attractive, like, girls, my eyes are up here attractive. you know that feeling, single line, ladies, no pushing. Plenty here for everybody. So I never happened, but I like to think that way. Anyway, and I drank that way for the rest of my drinking career. For the next 12 years, I drank that way pretty much every day. I drank because I thought it made me perform better. It made me smarter. It made me drive better. Some people disagreed, but I felt better driving. It made me sharper, and it made me feel like a human being for the first time. And I don't know any non-alcoholics who drink who say that when they drink, it makes them feel like a human being. Mm-hmm. But mine, it did for me. It filled in something in me that I didn't have before, and I had no idea what that was. I thought everybody got that effect from alcohol. I thought that's what alcohol was for, was to have for everybody to feel that way, to feel deeply about things. I've heard people say, I usually drug users, but I hear them say that, you know, I drank to get out of the world, to get away from everything. Well, I drank to become part of the world. I felt far enough out of the world when I was not drinking. I felt far enough detached from things. And when I drank, it made me feel whole. And it made me feel connected. And it made me feel like I could breathe. And then, as everybody in this room knows, or else you sure wouldn't be here this morning, something changed. And I started to have more consequences to my drinking. I started to have more trouble with my drinking. I started to make rationalizations about my drinking. I started to involve other people with my drinking and get in trouble and embarrass them or humiliate them or hurt them. And I don't mean punching people. You can hurt people a lot worse with your vocabulary than you can with your fists, truly. And because once you've hit them, the bruise goes away. But once you've told them something that they can't unhear, that stays forever. And that's and so I had done that. And I was ashamed. I was always ashamed. I was always embarrassed. I always felt guilty all the time. And I didn't know why. No matter how much I drank, I couldn't stop drinking. But when I did drink, I couldn't turn off all of that noise. I didn't feel like I was relieved of life. I didn't feel like I was reconnected to the world. I felt detached and lost and drunk. And I wound up being brought to an AA meeting by a woman who I was bringing her to the meeting, and she convinced me to come in because she and I drank together. And she needed a ride to an AA meeting, and I picked her up, and she 12-stepped me in the car on the way to the meeting. I was just going to drop her off. She had 22 days of sobriety. And she 12-stepped me. And she told me what she found when she was in detox. She was in a detox back in the day when, I mean, Betty Ford wasn't even open then. It was a place called the Care Unit. You know, and she was in there, and AA hospitals and institutions panels came in and spoke to them. And she didn't make it in sobriety. She's sober now. She's not drinking now. She never has gone into AA again. She got 30 days and left, and left me there. And yet, I am a beneficiary of the hospitals and institutions work. Because if they had not brought the message to her, she wouldn't have brought it to me. And she didn't bring it to me in any kind of a way that, I mean, if she had told me what I should be doing or how I should behave or what she learned from this high position of sobriety, I would never have come back. I would have thought, you are so full of crap. Get out of here. That's not the problem. The problem is, how much burnt toast should you eat before you start drinking? I need to know stuff like that. I need to know what the latest treatments in alcoholism are so I can drink safely. You know, I don't need to hear your pious crap about a higher power doing what, you know, falling into the flow of things. No, I just need to know what I need right now. And so she brought me to the meeting. Like I said, she didn't stay. I did. And not because I was a better person than her. I was just probably, at that moment, more desperate than she was. And I stayed. I wound up getting a sponsor named Bill McDonald, who died about 2 months ago. And he walked me through my first 26 years of sobriety. and he had me active. He had me doing the steps, and I didn't even know I was doing them. Because I don't, it's my belief now, and based on the people I've come up in sobriety with, like Bob and Sue, and anybody else in this room, Mike, and there are other people in here I know, I don't know that I could take the steps just sitting down and reading them in the book. Bill said from the first time I asked him, he said, okay, you're going to get a commitment at all of your meetings that you go to, and I want you at least 6 meetings a week. You can have one meeting off, one night off. And I thought, that don't work for you. You know, I didn't say that. I said, okay. And you have to have a commitment at every meeting, and you need to have a job there where you do something. Do something. Okay. So I got commitments. I did those. And I want you to go out for coffee with everybody after the meeting so you can get to know people. Oh, people. Oh, God. No, not coffee with people. I want you to go around the meeting before when you get there, and I want you to shake everybody's hand. And if you don't know them, ask them their name. And if you know them, call them by their name. I want you to get phone numbers from the men. I want you to call one guy every day and tell him that you met him at the meeting last night and that you hope he's not having a good day and you hope to see him tonight. And that's that. And call me every day. So I did all those things, and it was just like I was in an ox yoke. You know, you've got the thing over your neck and your hands are in shackles and you have to do everything they tell you to do. And what happened was, but by the time I got 8 months sober, I felt like I was being used by AA. I see what you do here. This is a cult. It's the world's worst cult. They tell you to go back to your family, don't stop giving us a lot of money, be kind to people, don't tell them what you're doing, you know. And so I did what he told me to do. And at 8 months sober, I was standing at a meeting feeling sorry for myself because I was mopping the floor like as the Irish were built to do. And it occurred to me when I looked up at the people standing there to thank the speaker that I knew every single one of them by name and I liked them. And it just hit me. It just leveled me out. And I asked him, when are we going to do the first 3 steps? And he said, are you doing everything I ask you to do? And I said, yeah. And he said, what are you talking about? And I said, well, when are we actually going to do the steps? He said, which part of the first 3 steps do you think you're not doing? It's a lot more than talk. We're not going to sit knee to knee and wish ourselves into turning our will in our life. You either do it or you don't. You either come to believe. You can't make yourself come to believe. I can't sit there and go, okay, I wish I'd come to believe, and click my heels together 3 times. I believe. And everything becomes technicolor. It doesn't work that way. It's drudgery sometimes, but I had to do it, because if I didn't do it, I would have drunk again. I know I would have, because I would have forgotten what I was. And when the act of doing these things that we ask people to do around here became too much, I would drink again, because I'd forget what I was, and I would think that maybe that would get me back to some normalcy. I'd feel better, you know, quickly. And it changed. That event changed me. And I did all the steps. And I, I went back to school, and I got a good head start on a degree, on a master's degree. And I started teaching at a Catholic school. I didn't have a credential, so I went back to get my teacher's credential and all that stuff. And I taught for 7 years. And I thought, this is exactly what, maybe this is what I was supposed to do, you know. I'd be unloading trucks, which is what I was doing before, and over a period, I got married, I had 2 children, I got a new career, right? I got snatched out of teaching to write full time. I made a living writing for 30 years, and then and in the meantime, my sponsor drank again. He had 33 years when he drank again. And I was desperate. And I've been friends with Bob for a long time and always looked up to him, as he was, like, when I was new, Bob would speak at my home group, and I think, you know, he's an old timer, esteemed old timer that people looked up to. And then he was friendly to me, and so he became a friend. And we would talk on the phone from time to time, and he would give me direction when I felt like there was something that my sponsor wasn't, my sponsor would say, call Bob Regan. And so I would call Bob. And so when Bill drank, the first thing I did when I got off the phone with him, literally the first thing, I put the phone down and I picked it up again and I called Bob and said, would you sponsor me? And this is 2000, I have to say it was 2006 or 7, right around there. 2007, yeah. And Bob changed my life. He changed the whole course of my life at that point too, because I was going through a terrible divorce. I wound up with full custody of my children, and everything was seen to be like erupting. Things were falling apart, and Bob was that sane island that always had something that he had learned that he shared with me that he learned, and it helped me. It kept me moving. And just to end, I'm probably near the end here, right? 2 minutes. Okay, 1 minute, 30 seconds. Do I hear 20 seconds? So, okay. I'm glad you didn't go. So, I'll tell you, I'm going to tell you something from the truth. I hit financial.
Sorry?
I ran into a patch where I was not making enough money to survive. I had not planned well. I retired at 66 and had not planned well. And things started to snowball and I wound up in debt, and I went to Bob and said, well, you know, I don't know what to do. And he said, well, you have an income problem. I said, yeah, I can see that. And he goes, well, you need to get more income. Light bulb. And he said, you know how to teach. Why don't you go back and be a substitute teacher? So I did that. And then I got a long-term substitution. And I went back into teaching thinking, I know how to do this. I can do this. But I hadn't done it for 30 years. And I found out that some things are not transferable. Some things do not grow in the interim. And it's been hard. And it's been revealing as to, it's been humbling, I'll put it that way. Which is exactly, must be what I need. But I know one thing, and that is that I trust my sponsor. I trust Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have for 44 years. I trust the process of that when higher power stays with me through. And I also know that I have learned how to love these kids. You know, even though I'm shocked that more school shootings aren't done by teachers. I found through the examples I've had in here that I really do love these kids. I'm in the right place. It's hard some days, but so what? I'm guided by a higher power. I have a great sponsor. I have great friends that I love, and I have you. So thanks for having me.
Thank you, Charlie. And next with 48 years, we have Sue R., please.
Hi, I'm Sue. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sue.
Thank you so much, Mike, for asking me to... There you are. For asking me to share my experience, strength, and hope today. I have absolutely no idea what I'm going to say. I'm just all muddled up here. But I loved listening to Charlie, and he made me laugh. And I'll tell you something. It was the laughter in Alcoholics Anonymous that saved my life. When I crawled in here in 1976, I was 23 years old, and I felt like I was going to die or go insane. And it was the laughter in these rooms that kept me coming back. And I didn't know if I was really an alcoholic. I'd sit out there, and I grew up in an alcoholic home, and I swore I'd never drink like my dad. And I thought, how in the world could I be an alcoholic? Am I really an alcoholic? Aren't I too young? I'm 23. And the laughter in these rooms kept me coming back. I was just drawn to it like a moth to a flame, literally. And one day at a time, I kept coming back. And I want to welcome our two new people here. I'm so glad. I always love when we have new people because I never want to forget where I came from. And when I got sober in 1976, it seemed like every single time I'd get up at a podium, come into a medium, somebody would get up at a podium like this and they'd say, if you're sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, I mean, that just resonated throughout my whole entire being. I was so sick and tired. And the main thing I was sick and tired of was that I couldn't live up to my word. You know, I wasn't raised to live like that, but I was never able to do anything I said I was going to do. And I felt so bad about it. And I love that the theme here is I am responsible, and that we have that responsibility pledge here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got sober where Charlie got sober. And one of the first things my sponsor told me is the program is based on love and service. And she said, but we don't do this just when we're in the mood for it. She said, it's a discipline. We do this day in, day out. And you'll have a schedule of meetings. And if you have a meeting on a certain night, that's the most important thing, is for you to show up at that meeting. And these commitments, these service commitments that Charlie talked about, that I ended up getting, like washing ashtrays, taking cookies to the Sunday night meeting, all these little things like that. And when I was first asked to do things like that in Alcoholics Anonymous, especially the cookie lady, that sounded like a big deal. I thought, gosh, these alcoholics, they're going to be waiting for those cookies, you know. And don't they know that you can't count on me for anything? You can't count on me for anything. And one day at a time, I showed up and brought the cookies every single Sunday night. And at the end of that time, I felt like a spiritual giant just because I had been able to do that. And I could see that Alcoholics Anonymous was making a difference in my life. But I'll tell you, the first time that I remember drinking, because like I said, I grew up in an alcoholic home, and I was never going to drink and be like my dad. And so I lived up to that vow until I was about 12 or 13 years old. And then I went with my parents on a trip, and I got to take my little girlfriend along with us, and we talked a man into buying us a bottle of booze. I don't know what it was, scotch, whiskey, bourbon, something. And he brought it up to our room. We were on a different wing of the hotel than my parents. And thankfully, he just left it with us. And so we drank the whole thing, and I came out of a blackout in the lobby of the hotel in seersucker pajamas and a sombrero. And we were in Atlanta, Georgia. No idea where I got a sombrero, but I fell in love with alcohol. You know, like the book says, I love the feeling produced by alcohol because I don't care about anything anymore. I'm not scared that my dad's going to come home drunk, and are we going to be up all night long while he, you know, rages through the house. And thankfully, he was never physically violent, but it was terrifying. And that fear was gone, and my insecurity and everything. It was just all gone, you know. And alcohol did something for me. When I first got sober in 1976, down in the Pacific Group in West L.A., I heard Clancy say, alcohol does something for the alcoholic, it doesn't do for the general population. And when he first said that, I thought, oh, they're just making that up so we won't feel bad. But I have come to believe that that's true, and that I have that abnormal reaction to alcohol, and the book calls it an allergy, and I think I have it, and I think I still have it. And to this day, you know, I've been sober over 48, almost 49 years in 2 weeks, and haven't had a drink. But I think all it takes is just that one drink to reactivate this disease that is part of me. You know, it's in me. It's in my DNA. I believe that. And, you know, whether it's true or not doesn't matter. I believe that's true. And so I am really, really grateful that I landed here in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I don't know if those pajamas got urine-soaked like Charlie was talking about. I don't remember them getting urine-soaked, but I do know that I vomited in a trash can. And when I woke up the next day, that room was vile. It smelled bad. It was horrible. And yet, what I remembered, my takeaway from that experience was, this is the best thing I had ever had. I mean, this was the best time I had ever had, and I couldn't wait to drink again. So I was willing to pay the price. I was willing to pay the price for drinking. And there are not that many opportunities to drink at that early age, but I started sneaking across the state line to Mississippi, where you can drink at age 18. And there was a bar where we would go, and I didn't even have a fake ID, but they would serve us anyway. And this was my favorite place on earth. You know, they talk about Disneyland is the happiest place on earth. This bar was my favorite place on earth, and I couldn't wait to go back there. And I was supposed to go to University of Alabama when I graduated from high school, but I decided to go to an all-girls school in the same town with this bar because I didn't want to get too far away from that bar. I had sort of struck up something with the bass player in the band, and that was another thing for me. Alcohol, booze, and boys just seem to go together. I'm seeing some heads nodding, and I'm glad. And that was, you know, that was my life. And I had been a really good student. I had been really motivated. I loved doing well in school. I loved getting my teacher's approval, my parents' approval, and all of that. But once I got a taste of alcohol, there was just no comparison. And I didn't see this happening at the time, but it just took me down a dark road. And slowly but surely, anything that was healthy or good just left my world and just kind of went off the radar screen. And I became the classic underachiever because I was just searching for that high. I just wanted to party. I just wanted to drink and have fun. And while I was in this school, we were not allowed to go to this bar where I loved to go. And so I would sneak out every night, and I would walk out with a stack of books because we were only allowed to go to the library at night. So I go out with a stack of books and go out to this bar, and I got caught. Long story short, I got caught. My mother was looking for me. She tried to call me. She couldn't find me. We didn't have cell phones in those days. And she had to involve the school, and they couldn't find me, so they called the police. And the police found me with the bass player, unfortunately. And so the school gave me this ultimatum. It was like, you know, shape up or ship out kind of a thing. And I knew there was no way I was going to survive in this school. You know, I never once thought, oh, maybe I should only drink on the weekend. Or, oh, maybe I should do my schoolwork before I start drinking. Or, no, never had a thought like that. Never thought of alcohol as a problem at all. I thought, I'd better transfer to the University of Alabama because I can live in an apartment there and nobody will know what I'm doing. That was my solution. But when my mother and dad picked me up at the police station, that's a day that I never want to forget, because when I walked in there, I loved my mother with all my heart. I still do. She's 97 years old. She lives on the Gulf Coast of Alabama. And she was the choir director and sometimes played the piano or the organ for our church, the First Presbyterian Church. And my mother seemed like a saint to me. But the thing that saved her from being too pious was she had a killer sense of humor. And I just adored her. I loved her with all my heart. And I felt so bad for what she was going through with my dad, the alcoholic. And that day when I walked in there and my mother was crying in the police station, I felt like the lowest creature on the earth, just the lowest creature that there is. And I wanted to go up and hug her and say, Mom, I promise you I'll never do anything like this again. I'm going to go back to school. I'm going to make you proud of me. But I didn't say those words because somewhere deep down inside of me, even at age 18, I knew this wasn't the last time something like this would happen. I knew I was powerless, but I didn't know I was powerless over alcohol. I just knew I couldn't be good for very long. That was all I knew. So I did transfer to University of Alabama, and I met a guy there who had come out from California on a motorcycle. He was stoned on Reds and sort of like this on a sofa when I first saw him, and it was love at first sight. I couldn't wait to come out to California with this guy, because I had been to Coronado to visit my aunt when I was 16, and I thought, everybody's surfing and the sun is always shining and I'm never going to have a bad day in California. And so he was arrested for sales of cocaine, and I didn't let that slow me down. As soon as he got his probation after being in jail transferred, I came out here to California with him, and I just hit the skids. I went from bad to worse, and I just, you know, was circling the drain by the time I was 23 years old. And I ended up at the UCLA emergency room, lying on a gurney in the hallway. And I lay there and I cried, and I felt like I was the loneliest person in the world. And I still didn't know that this had anything to do with alcohol. I just knew that I was really sick. And my life had gotten to the point where it was very small and very dark. And all I did was get up and go to work and try to make it through the day. And I was making excuses to go home, and I was always sick. And I'd get in the car to come home, and I would look for a liquor store where nobody knew me between downtown L.A. and West L.A., and I would end up getting lost on the way home from work. And I didn't know about the freeway flyer, but I would stop, and I would get my bottle of wine, and I would start drinking in the parking lot or in the car or whatever, and I would end up getting lost on the way home to my own apartment. And I was afraid to go out. I was afraid not to go out. I was just full of fear. And so this one day, my girlfriend, Dana, took me to the UCLA emergency room, and I lay there, like I said, crying. And I felt like I was the loneliest person in the world. And they wanted to send me to, they referred me to a specialist. And I had been going to so many doctors. One of my big problems was insomnia. I couldn't sleep. So I had lots of sleeping pills and tranquilizers and stuff. And the big book talks about that, you know, that doctors will start prescribing these heavy sedatives and stuff. And that was what happened to me. And I had all this stuff, and I was combining it and drinking, but I always drank, and I would, you know, I would drink a fifth of wine to go to sleep at night, along with my sleeping pills and stuff. I mean, it's amazing that I lived to tell this story, I think. I was at the bottom. I had a moment of clarity that day, and I thought, oh my God, you're drinking just like your dad. You're an alcoholic, Sue. And I got on the phone, and I called the central office in downtown L.A., and a woman answered the phone, and she said, I said, you know, I feel like bugs are crawling on my skin, and my arms and legs are going numb, and I hear voices, and do you think this has anything to do with drinking? She said, yeah, honey, and it gets worse. And I knew she knew. I had sat across from the desk, all those doctors, and nobody could figure out what was wrong or anything. This lady knew, and I knew she knew. It was the first time I heard the language of the heart that I have later heard so much here in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it saved my life, saved my life. She said, would you be willing to go to a meeting? And I said, I'd do anything. So they sent a lady named Marty Ligori out to get me, and she drove me to meetings every night for that first week. And what I noticed about Marty, when I got in the car with her, she was talking a mile a minute. She said, we don't take the first drink or anything that affects us from the neck up. And I knew she was talking about those sleeping pills and those tranquilizers. I knew it was all, it all had to go. And she drove me to meetings every night for that first week, and she was talking a mile a minute. But one of the major things I noticed was Marty smelled good. And I knew I didn't. I felt like stale booze was seeping out of my pores and stale cigarette smoke and everything else. And Marty smelled good. She was an attraction to the program. You know, sometimes they say you might be the first copy of the big book someone sees. And Marty was that for me. She was that first copy of the big book, and I wanted what she had. I was 23 years old. She was a much older woman, much older. She was probably all the way in her 50s by then. But I wanted what she had, and she took me to that meeting. And I went to my first Pacific Group meeting. Like I said, it's a gigantic meeting. There are like 400 people there. I was filled with fear, and a woman walked up to me in that room, and she was only 2 years older than me, and she was 2 years sober. Her name was Pam, and she had this big, beautiful smile on her face, and her eyes were sparkling. And to this day, I can't tell you what she said to me, but she did give me her number, and she wrote my sobriety date in a big book, and she said, this will be your sobriety date. And later on, when I heard Norm Alpe speak on one of his talks, he said, who you are, speak so loud, I can't hear a word you're saying. And that's what it felt like. It reminded me of when I met Pam that night. I knew that I could trust her, and I didn't trust anybody. I didn't trust anybody in the world, and I felt safe with her, and I wanted to stay close to her. And she told me to call her, and I said, would you be my sponsor? Because I heard all this buzz around me, get a sponsor, get a sponsor, get a sponsor, work the steps. And she said, yes, she would. And she became my sponsor, and she saved my life, and I loved her with all my heart. And We lost her some years ago, way too early. She was only around 60 years old. But things that she said and her smile and her laugh have stayed with me, and they are just a permanent part of my heart and soul. It's just emblazoned inside of me, what she gave to me, you know. And like I said, she was 26 years old, and she was sober 2 years. And she was the perfect sponsor for me. She was the perfect sponsor for me. And one day at a time, my life has changed, and over any given period of time, for the better. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I think is the most remarkable thing is that I can be happy, joyous, and free on an ordinary day doing ordinary stuff. To me, that is the miracle of this program, because I felt like I was born worried and born bored. And here I learned that I can be happy, joyous, and free on an ordinary day doing ordinary stuff. And I really love that. But it's also true that my husband Bob and I have been able to travel a lot and do a lot of fun things and have a lot of interesting experiences. And I'm really grateful for that. And I just want to tell you a tiny little story that I like, and I just got the idea about this a minute ago. I hope I can tell it. I haven't thought about it for a while. But we went on a sober trip. We like to go on these sober trips where it's like 500 sober alcoholics and Al-Anons, and they have meetings every night, and, you know, there's always something to do. And so at one of these meetings, we had our Al-Anon, one night a week, we have an Al-Anon speaker. And our Al-Anon speaker was a lady named Kathy from Ohio. And I hope she'll forgive me for telling her the story of hers, because I love it so much. Lynn is nodding, so I think she probably knows it. But Kathy said that she had a friend, and something went on, and her little son was suddenly going to not a public school, but a private school, like a church school type thing. And he came home and said he learned the Lord's Prayer. And she thought, okay, well, you know, I'm busy. I don't have time to talk about this now, but we'll talk about it later, whatever. And then that night, she was walking down the hall, and she sees her little son in his room. He's down on his knees, and he's got his hands folded. And she stops in her tracks, and she listens to him saying, "Our Father, who art in heaven, how'd you know my name?" And Kathy said, "I'm so grateful to be in a program that has connected me with the God who knows my name." And so am I. So am I. Thank you all for having me here.
Thank you, Sue. And next, with 50 years, we have Judy F.
I gotta shake my leg out here. My name's Judy, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm so grateful I got to sit in the first seat here, because I have a gimpy leg today. And I never thought I'd sit in a meeting and say that I have a gimpy leg, and it's because I'm old. And my sobriety date is February 23rd, 1975. And I have to say that in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 22 years old. I never would have thought that I would be sharing at an old-timers meeting, and I want to know what happened. Was I present for it all? Thank you so much. I identified with everybody who's been up here so far. I want to tell you, I had an experience this week. I was watching a commercial, and the commercial was on some sort of medication that they're telling people to take for something. But you know, at the very end, how they tell you that you might suffer from these things if you take this medication. And it said, "Do not take this medication if you're allergic to it." And I thought, well, how would I know if I was allergic to it unless I took it? Mm-hmm. And then I thought, well, that's true with alcohol. If I had known I was allergic to it, would I have ever taken that first drink? I don't know. I grew up in an alcoholic home. My dad was an alcoholic. He was a periodic. I never knew that he drank. He never drank at home. I drank very, very similar to him. I was a periodic, and I never drank at home. And I also had an alcoholic brother. And my parents, my dad was in and out of AA before I was ever born. He got sober in Ohio, in Akron. That sounds familiar. But it didn't matter that he got sober in Akron, because he couldn't stay sober for 22 years. So whether he actually, you know, met anybody important back there, I don't know. It didn't make any difference. But my parents were at an Alcoholics Anonymous convention, and I was about 12 or 13 years old. And my brother was home. He was in the military, and he was supposed to be watching us. Mm-hmm. And he decided that, because we never had alcohol in the home, never, that my sister and I needed to experience drinking or have a drink of alcohol. And so that was my first drink. It was my first drunk, and it was my first blackout. And I never drank any differently from that moment on until my last drink. And but he insisted, and, you know, my parents are at this Alcoholics Anonymous convention, and here's their children at home drinking and getting drunk and blacking out. And I don't actually remember that I had that feeling that other people talk about. I don't remember the whole weekend. And so when I was just graduating from high school, and the world was out there, and I am not a people person either. I like, people think I am, but I'm not. And when I drank, if I drank in a bar, I moved the chairs away from the table, because I didn't want anybody to sit with me. I was there, and I was there for one reason only, and it was not to socialize. And, you know, and for some odd reason, it's kind of like sitting in an AA meeting. Sometimes I like to go to a meeting and not have anybody sit with me. For some odd reason, that's like an attraction. They feel like you got to be sitting right next to me. And if I move over a chair to make room, they got to move over with me. And so, you know, it's hard to be in a bar drinking. And, you know, I was young. I wasn't 22 yet. And I was a lot taller for some reason. I was thin. I had this image of, like, that they used to have billboards with that slinky woman with her cigarette in her holder, and she was all in a black dress and everything, and that was who I became. And yet I didn't like people. So it was kind of I was odd, to say the least. And so when I had my my dad finally got sober, and he got sober at the Rafters, and I find it kind of amazing that I'm sitting at the same table with people from the Pacific group, because I got sober at the Rafters, and I'm going to make a comment about the Pacific group, because I was young, that I did not get along with people from the Pacific when I got sober, because I had this idea that the only thing that I was going to have to do in Alcoholics Anonymous was just not drink. Everybody else was going to have to take those steps. They were going to have to do all that service work and everything. But I wasn't, because I was smarter than the average alcoholic. And that you were going to have to do these things because, first of all, you drank more than I did, probably, and you were dumber. And and when I got sober, there weren't a lot of women. I mean, when I went to the Rafters the first time, there were old men there. And, you know, they were probably in their 30s. but I used to go to noon meetings, and all of these men would be sitting in these noon meetings, and so they were my examples. You don't work. You don't have to work. You drive new cars, and you can sit around all day and just chit-chat. And that was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so when you know, I had been working, I didn't know how to hold jobs down too much because I didn't like that commitment. You know, they expected you to be there at 8 o'clock and work until such and such a time. And 8 was early, and working until 5, that kind of cut into a lot of my playtime and stuff. So I didn't know how to be accountable at a job, so I didn't keep them for very long. If I showed up, sometimes I'd get jobs and I wouldn't show up at them. And this is sober, you know, because I knew nothing about accountability. I knew nothing about commitments. I just thought that life was just about having fun. And I had been working, and I quit my job because didn't they know who I was? And I was working in a home for functionally disabled people, and they didn't know who I was. I could have lived there with these people at one point. And so, anyways, I quit my job, and I was sober just a few months when I quit it, and I was living at home. I had quit school, I had quit this job, and I was living at home. And my dad was very curious as to how my job hunting was going as I was laying by his pool, sunning myself. And he'd come home. You know, when you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, you pick up the lingo. You know, don't worry, God's got it. First things first. Knew not a clue as to what any of them meant, but I had them down pat. So my dad came over, I was laying by his pool, and he said, "So how did the job hunting go today?" And I was surprised, you know, am I supposed to be looking for a job? And I said, "Don't worry, Dad, God's got it." And he walked away and he was shaking his head. So he went to these men that I was going to noon meetings with and said, "You've got it. Don't let her come to any more meetings until she finds a job." So he sent me to these men, and they helped me fill out. And that was when you filled out applications and you took them in. And so these men helped me fill out an application so I could carry it with me to go on a job interview. And the reason I wasn't getting any jobs was because I put down every single job I'd ever had. And if they called, they wouldn't even know who I was. So they helped me fill this application out. And then I went on my first job interview. I had to get there 3 hours early because I was sure I wasn't going to go in. And I went in, did the interview. They hired me on the spot. I stayed at that job for over 30 years because I knew I didn't want that experience again. And I was sober, yet I didn't know that there was something that was going to happen to me that would give me the courage to be able to do that again, that would be able to give me the courage to stand up here today. You know, I didn't know that there was going to be a transformation in me that would attract people to me. Just like you were sharing, is that I know today that I'm an example of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I've been through all of the, I've been chairperson of the convention, I've been in H&I, I did all of those things, and man, I resented them to hell. Because the spirit wasn't there. And I think that that's what has to be present for you to really comprehend and understand that service that you're doing. To be non-resentful. To be challenged by it in what you're going to be doing. I worked for a lot of years, and when I retired, I was kind of like Charlie. I didn't have it up here that I was going to be able to. My sponsor, by the way, I'm current with my sponsor today. I have a sponsor. I'm in two book studies a week. Those are the things that I do to keep me accountable, first of all, and to keep me learning. God, I never want to get bored in this program. Mm. I know what being bored in this program is like. I get restless, irritable, and discontent. Mm. And man, I want to do things. I always thought I was going to be somebody when I got sober, you know. And I had that attitude, man. Don't you know who I am? The police have been called on me in sobriety. I've been removed from places in sobriety because of, well, I thought it was for other people, but it was because of my attitude and my pride. God, that pride is such a terrible thing. It is such a terrible thing. And I'm okay?
7 minutes.
Oh, good. I didn't think I could talk for 20 minutes. But I guess those are the things that, you know, I am a follower of Bill W. I just absolutely love Bill. I talk about him a lot. I think I know him. I do a lot of reading of his material and stuff. And when he talks about that emotional sobriety, you know, and he had that, you know, that letter that he wrote. He wrote the 12 steps when he was, God, just newly sober. Newly sober when you think about it. And then, you know, he wrote the letter on emotional sobriety when he was like 15 years sober. How much he had grown in that period. And the things that he realized that he would need to do in order to maintain his sobriety. And that's where, to me, where that emotional sobriety comes in, is in those, it's going back to those steps. It's in looking at step 6 and 7 and understanding the character defects that with 50 years of sobriety, I still have. You know, just because I took step 7 or so I thought I did, they didn't just magically go away because I thought I had to do it. And I had to go back to step 7 and reread it and do the 7th step prayer and understand that maybe he doesn't want all of that crap. You know, maybe he wants me to continue learning from it. And I do on a daily basis. I do on a daily basis. I had to make amends the other day at a meeting. It was a business meeting, so, you know, it's okay if you lose your cool so long as you make amends afterwards. But, 'cause we all know how business meetings are. And I realized that because I was in fear that I chose somebody to make fun of and to make them look smaller so that I felt bigger. And that's a big character defect of mine. And so after the meeting, I realized that I owed an amends. And so I went up and I made an amends after the meeting. And the relief, I mean, it's amazing what, it's not some of your forgiveness, sometimes it's some of my own forgiveness. And realizing that it's so true what the book says is that we strive for progress, not perfection. And I always wanted that perfection. You know, I wanted it in you so that I didn't have to work so hard. And today, that I'm just one of God's kids. I'm just one of God's kids doing the best that I can. And I found a difference in the service work that I do. I found a different kind of service work. A lot of people, if you're from Santa Clarita, know what time Central Office is open and the days that it's open. But I get the privilege of going and unlocking the door, answering the phone, being of service there, and I found home. It's just amazing. I just opened myself up. God, please show me what it is I'm supposed to do in retirement, because I didn't know. You know, I didn't know. And he directed me, and today I get to be of service for Central Office. I get to be of service in general service work, and my heart is so much freer today. It's open. It's open to any possibility that God has to offer me. And from that 22-year-old who sat in a meeting and wanted to flip everybody off because they were sitting too close, to my dad and I arguing about Clancy, and my dad loved Clancy. He absolutely adored Clancy, and we got into these fights all the time because I was a little bullheaded, and I thought that maybe I should be in Clancy's shoes rather than Clancy. And those are two biggest shoes to fill today. You know, I just want to be a person among people. I want to just be just a simple alcoholic going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and if at all possible, be some sort of an attraction. And the only way I can do that is if I'm taking God with me, and I am level with everybody. I'm not up here, I'm not down here, I'm just level, sitting in a seat and allowing somebody to sit next to me, sticking out my hand and saying, "Hi, I'm Judy." And doing those things that I never thought I was going to have to do. And today I am in the best, I am the happiest, I am in the most joyous spot I have ever been in. And for that, I am so, so, so grateful. Thank you.
And last but not least, for the 58 years, we have Bob R.
Oh, wow. Who are men for the exits?
I'm Bob, an alcoholic.
Hi, Bob.
Thank you for allowing me to come out here. To even the guy that invited me is leaving. I'd like to thank the two lady speakers and the 27-minute participant. the rest of us are just going to have a little fun today. So, I'm going to tell you about... Well, first of all, my sobriety date is January 24th, 1967. So I'm 58 and a half years sober. And I've averaged three or four meetings a week for 58 and a half years. So it's not like I've come and gone or taken a vacation. I couldn't afford a vacation. When I came in, I was desperate, like Charlie said. And I'm so grateful because I was raising up Irish Catholic family in New England, studies were very important, academics were very important, and so they expect a lot of me and my brother and sister. Neither my brother and sister are alcoholic, nor were my parents alcoholic, and I didn't know I was alcoholic. I was a good kid. I found my few years after my mother died, I found this baby book that she had for me for the first 5 years of my life. And in the baby book, the first 4 years, she wrote these two pages of wonderful things about us, what a sweet little boy I was, how helpful and sweet and kind, just everything positive for 4 years. And my fifth birthday, she wrote one sentence that not as nice as he used to be. So that's what you're going to get today, friend. I like our friend Don Locke. He used to talk to people in the audience by name. Yeah. he came out there about 15 years ago, and he said, 20 years ago, and he said at the convention, he said he had a little dark side to him, too. Anyway, he came up, and he said, would you sponsor me? And I said, I will if you won't tell anybody. So that explains Don.
Yeah.
He's still, and he's a nursing home down by Ohio Street meeting, and he's still hanging in there, barely by a thread. But we went and saw him a year or so ago. Charlie and I went. I'm going to skip through the drinking pretty fast. My drinking got bad fast. But it was ingrained in me that you have to graduate. You have to. When you start something, you got to quit. You can't quit. It was bred into me. And so I got through high school well. I was accepted at a number of colleges. And I chose to go to Notre Dame. I see Bruce left. He had his USC hat on. We're playing Notre Dame's playing USC tonight.
Yep.
And he listened to the first three speakers, but and he asked me to sponsor him a year ago at this meeting. Anyway, hell with him. So I got to go to Notre Dame, and in my freshman year, they locked us up. We couldn't get at alcohol, and so I so I got good grades, and everybody's proud of me. And sophomore year, I learned the ropes, how to get down the fire escape into town, and so on. And my grades suffered, and I was on disciplinary and academic probation for the next 3 years. But like I said, it was bred into me that you finish what you start. And so I studied enough, and my grades were barely good enough, but I graduated with my class. And sometimes I make light of it, make people think I just went there and drank for 4 years. I did not. I studied. I did my work. I did the work. You don't get a business degree in 4 years from Notre Dame by being drunk all the time. And then as soon as I got out, I got a draft notice, so I hurriedly signed up for Navy OCS, and they sent me to Newport, Rhode Island. And again, they locked me up for 18 weeks with everybody else. And during those 18 weeks, I couldn't get alcohol, and so I was commissioned. And they said, "You're now an officer and a gentleman." I remained an officer for the next 4.5 years, gentleman for almost 24 hours. I thought I'd join the Navy because I saw the billboards. The billboard says, "Join the Navy and see the world." And they had billboards with Hawaii, the Caribbean, and the Mediterranean. Now, I got to go one of those three. So my first set of orders were to Kodiak, Alaska.
Oh.
But I didn't get to go. I bought the uniforms to go. And then the day after I got them, I got a change of orders to go to Asmara, Eritrea, Ethiopia, on the other side of Africa. Not this side, the other side of Africa. So I went there for the next year and a half. And I drank, and my drinking got me in trouble. But again, whenever the chips really got down, I became like the poster boy for the Navy. I would do his work and her work and everybody else. And everybody liked me when I was not drinking. But I drank whenever I could. And the big thing, I think, one of the big things was I had an affinity for sports and for how to coach sports teams. And so the commanding officer had me coaching all. He hated the Army, and we were not Army, but we were a tenant unit on Army base. They had like 11 Army teams and one Navy team, and they just beat the hell out of the Navy teams, all of them. And this guy, this commanding officer, said, "You're the new athletic officer and a coach of every team." And I said, "Okay." And so we started beating the thunder out of the Army, and he just loved it. And my drinking and my problems and all that shit weren't so bad that he tried to get rid of me. He kept me. And so when I finished up my tour there, I was promoted on time. My next set of orders were the Pentagon and the Chief of Naval Operations Communications Office, and I was there for the next year plus. And during that time, it was a tough time in the Navy. It was a tough time in the country. And when I was in OCS, they had the Bay of Pigs invasion. And it was a real serious time. And I was in Ethiopia when they had the Cuban Missile Crisis. And we didn't know if the next missile was going to land on us in Ethiopia or not. And then when I was in the Pentagon working and I was on duty, President Kennedy was shot. And so all these big things, and we were the hub of all the communications for the Navy and for the Joint Chief of Staff and the White House and everybody else. And so it all came through us. And so I made it through that, and I might have stayed in the Navy, except I knew they didn't have any alcoholism programs or anything like that. I was doomed if I stayed in. That I could, my drinking was getting worse. So I got out of the Navy. I was dating someone, and a month after I got out of the Navy, we got married, and she left me about 40 times in the first year we were married. Several of those times for a week at a time, but mostly for one or two nights, all around my drinking. And finally, and I was fired from three jobs not because of my drinking as much as when I drink, I wouldn't show up for work, and they didn't like that. And so I finally got a job that's transferred me out to Southern California, and it was in the San Fernando Valley, and I really liked it because you had no humidity. I could take the heat, but not the humidity, and so I liked it, and I drank out here for the next year and a half, and finally I just hit bottom. I just couldn't go on anymore. I'm drinking, getting up in the morning and starting to drink immediately, and I'm passing out. I blacked out. I went, came to one morning in my house, and I remembered somebody. There was only, what was it? When I was in college, we'd hitchhike back to Massachusetts at semester break, or when the year was over, we'd stop in New York, and we'd meet in Charlie's Bar around the perimeter of Grand Central Station, and we'd meet there, all of us hitchhiking separately. And so we'd meet there, and I was in the early group to get there one morning about 6:30. So we go in there, and this about 20 minutes later, this businessman walked in. Neat suit, it looked like the Mad Men thing, had a little thin briefcase, and went down the other end of the bar, and a bartender came up and he poured him like a double shot. He tried to pick it up and he couldn't. And so he took it and he put it in a big schooner, like a 16-ounce schooner, and he picked it up and it was shooting like a flame. He couldn't get it up to his mouth. And so finally he took his necktie and set it down on the bar and slid that drink up his necktie and drank it, and it worked. And the bartender looked at him, and the bartender went down there, poured him another double in a smaller glass. He picked it up daintily and drank it down, straightened his tie and his suit, picked up his briefcase, and he walked out. And I said to my friends there at the bar, I said, if we ever get that bad, I'm going to quit drinking. Well, just before I sobered up, one morning I came to in Van Nuys in my bed, and I walked out into the kitchen, and I poured myself a drink, barely, and I tried to do it. It wouldn't work. And so I walked back. I had my undershirt and my underwear on. I crept back in the bedroom. I got a necktie. And I came in and tied the necktie over my T-shirt and held it down and slid it up my shirt, my tie, and it went down like a charm. So I'm not telling you newcomers to try that. It worked. And I thought to myself, when I told this guy, if it ever get that bad, I'll quit. Well, I didn't quit right then. A little while later, it got to the point where I got fired from my job. They repossessed my car. My mother came out to see the happy family, which wasn't. And finally, I threw in the towel, contacted a priest in Malibu, and he put me in touch with a woman, Alcoholics Anonymous. She took me to my first meeting, and the first meeting was the Arlington Group down in L.A., a speaker meeting, and Al Marino was the secretary and the leader every week and the boss of the meeting, and he controlled it, but they had good speakers and a big crowd. And so first week they had some woman speaker, I don't know who it was. The second week I went back, Norm Alpe was the speaker. So I got to meet Norm Alpe when I was a week sober. And it was about 11 days sober. They suckered me to go on this couple retreat down in Palos Verdes. And I went down there, and Chuck C. and his wife Elsa were there. So I got to meet Chuck and Elsa, and his next-door neighbor was Warren Snyder and his wife Betty. And so Warren saw that I was a newcomer, and so he became my sponsor. And so he gave me direction for the next 2 years. He got me into everything. I was answering phones at the central office. I was secretary of the meeting. I got involved in general service. I was a GSR and then a district committee member. I was doing all these things for like the next 2 years. And then he got galloping leukemia and he died in 6 days. He had me on all these things. He was 56 years old. And so I went to call Betty and I said, I don't know what to do. And she said, well, call Chuck. I said, you don't just call Chuck. A month later, I called Chuck. Two weeks later, maybe. I called Chuck. He said, be down at my house at 10 o'clock Sunday morning. So I knocked on his door. I knew where he lived. I'd been back and forth from Warren and Betty's. They lived across the driveway. So I knocked on his door at 10 o'clock, and he let me in. He showed me where to sit, and he sat in his chair. And I started telling him my problems for about the next minute and a half. And he interrupted me, and he talked for the next 4 hours. And then he looked at his watch. He said, "It's time for you to go. The next guy's here." And we walked to the door, and sure enough, the next guy was standing there waiting to knock. But I floated home from Laguna up to Reseda, where I lived at the time, or Van Nuys, I guess. Anyway, that's how it was. And so he became my sponsor, and he kept me active in Alcoholics Anonymous. He taught me some of the great lessons that I've learned and tried to put into practice. I was on the retreat in 1975 where they made the tapes and the book, A New Pair of Glasses. I know the tapes by heart because I've had real down spots in my sobriety, broken marriages and disappointed kids and things, all kinds of things, lost jobs. My job thing was just when I got fired the day before I came to AA. And so I went out with the help of my cousin. 2 weeks later, I found a job. I kept it for a year. I was a year sober. I got fired. I got fired. I got another job. I kept it for 9 months. And they sold the company and let us all go. So I got fired again. 22 months sober. So I went out and got a good job. Looked hard. Got a good job. And I kept it for 5 years. And they said, "You're the best salesman west of the Mississippi." And you're going to be the next district sales manager, youngest one in the company. And then my boss got fired, and I figured that was the time. They brought in some guy from Milwaukee, made him the manager. And so here I am still a salesman, 7 years sober, and said, "There's no way you can fire me." So 3 months later, he fired me. 7 years sober, but I was on the move. You know, I'd been so active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd done all the jobs. I was doing all the jobs. I never missed the meetings. I just did all the AA stuff, and so anyway, I got this job, and I got fired from this job. It's the third one I got fired from sober, and I said, "Screw this!" I went out and started my own business. And I didn't get fired for the next 47 years. So, 3 years ago, I sold it, and I don't know if those numbers all correlate, but that's about what it was. 3 years ago, I sold a business, and I don't have to work anymore. But I worked till I was 84. I was looking to think, my Social Security, I started paying Social Security in 1952 when I was 15. And I've been paying in Social Security every year except one when I was a junior in college. Every year from that until 3 years ago when I retired. Wow. So I'm entitled to receive Social Security now. I'll tell you a couple about my friend. How much time we got?
3 minutes.
Three? Oh, okay, we got a guy out there that I know, big black man, good guy. His name is Mike H. Some of you know him. He about 35 years ago, he got out of prison, and he somehow got back to Oxnard where he had been from. He was drinking. I mean, couldn't stay sober, but he got a job in this liquor store that was owned by a guy in AA, and the only job he could get is a janitor. Anyway, about 2 weeks, and he was mopping the floor in the back, and all of a sudden he heard a commotion at the register, and he looked down the aisle, and some guy's holding up robbing the cashier. So he threw the mop down. Well, Mike's like 6'3" and weighed about 290. He threw the mop down, and he went after the guy, and the guy looked up, and he took off. And somehow Mike ran him down in the parking lot, laid on top of him. And the guy says, "Let me go." He says, "I'll let you go. Give me the money, I'll let you go." So the guy gave him the $35. And so Mike took the $35, and he walked back in, and he handed it to the cashier, and she said, "I didn't give him any money." Where but Alcoholics Anonymous do we hear things like that? That happened, you know? And I have stories. I got friends that go back, and it's just it's been a magnificent life. Sue and I met in 1994. She remembered me from I had spoken at the Pacific Group a number of times. She mentioned she saw me, and she said "You're one of the you're the Purple Panther coach from my daughter's team, softball team." And I said, "Yeah." And so we talked, and she was married to somebody, and I was married to somebody, and so we stayed friends, and we went to some of the same meetings for the next 17 years. and 2010 or 11, neither one of us were married to anybody for about a month. And we've been together ever since. And it's my great joy to try and add to her life. And I try to make her happy. I got time for one little story before you throw me off. She likes a certain cut of meat at the grocery store. And we have a grocery store that's like 2 miles from our house, real close. And she goes in there, but the woman that's behind the meat counter is the most miserable person. She's miserable to everybody. She clenches her teeth and she ignores you. She walks by and 4 or 5 times she goes to the back and she leans against the thing. Anyway, just so instead, Sue will drive into Camarillo, which is an hour round trip from our house, to get the meat, the same meat she can get 2 miles away, just so we don't have to deal with that woman. And so finally, I said, Sue, I'll go get it. I'll go get it. So I went in there and I said to myself, I'm going to just go in there. I'm going to say my nice little Catholic prayer and before I go in there. And I'm going to surround myself with the peaceful light that they talk about. And so I did. And I said my prayer and I said a couple more. And I took the basket and I walked in and I smiled at her. And she sort of broke. And she didn't say anything, and I told her what I needed, and all of a sudden she became pleasant, the same woman. And I'm just standing in this this aura of light that I'm thinking of, what did I bring here? And this little woman standing right about that far away, she comes into our light too, and she gets real happy. And so I think, wow. So I got the stuff, and I thanked her, and she thanked me, and I went and I paid for it. Now, then Sue couldn't figure it out. About every 3 days, I'm asking her if she needs some more meat. So, and that's all we do. That's all we need to do in Alcoholics Anonymous is say our little prayers and bring our little light and be kind to people and be gentle, and magic happens. Thanks a lot.
Oh, yes.